Right, so this is part two. So the question is, how can we use these insights to explain policy change, such as when we use case studies drawing on policy theories? I think that's what most of us are up to. Okay, so one way of doing that is to describe policy actors dealing with bounded rationality within policy-making environments. Now, the only issue there is that process is summed up in 101 different ways. So we need to begin by summing up all of those ways of understanding the policy process in one understandable way. Okay. So my favorite initial statement is something like, policymakers engage in a policy-making environment over which they have limited knowledge and even less control. And I like that statement because it's just as simple as its comparator, you know, something like the policy cycle, which portrays a simple and linear process in which a small number of policymakers have the power to produce the outcomes they want. It's important, I think, to come up with an equally simple description of the policy process to compete with the policy cycle idea, simply to compete with it, so that you give more attention to these more complicated policy theories than the policy cycle. Okay, so to do that, we have to make some heroic simplifications to start with, to describe a policy-making environment. So that's obviously a metaphor. In other weeks, we can talk about the meaning of the metaphor. It's an evolutionary metaphor. You know, this is about people adapting to their environments in some way. So we'll try and conceptualize the environment. Okay, and the other point to remember is each of these concepts I'm about to describe have literatures in their own right. We're kind of putting them together to describe this kind of complicated environment. Okay, so you would sum it up in five or six statements. First, there are many actors, including policymakers and influencers, spread across many levels and types of policymaking venues. The second thing we would say is that each of those venues contains its own institutions, and institutions are the formal and informal rules that people use to govern their own behavior. The third thing we would say is that each of those venues can produce its own networks, and networks are relationships between policymakers and influencers. And a key insight there, and in fact, one of the reasons why we use the word governance rather than government, is that there's a very blurry line between people who make policy or have the formal responsibility to make it, and the people who influence policy and they have some kind of informal role. The fourth thing we would say is that actors in each of these venues draw on a dominant set of beliefs about the nature of policy problems and the acceptable range of solutions. The fifth thing we would say is that socioeconomic factors limit the ability of policymakers to address and solve policy problems. And then finally, we would say that events help set the policy agenda and influence the resources available to actors. So if that all seems familiar, I've mostly copied and pasted that from chapter 13. Okay. So if you combine those short statements, they produce the broad sense that policymaking environments constrain and facilitate action. Okay, so these policymakers or policy actors, they're operating within this environment, and it's the environment that's providing most of the explanation for what's going on. People are adapting to something of which they have limited knowledge and even less control. So I think if you're looking for simple images of that, and if you do have access to the blog or the books, then there's a kind of an image we talk about a lot in which at the heart of it is people making choices using cognitive shortcuts, surrounded by an environment summed up by those concepts, you know, actors, institutions, networks, ideas, and socioeconomic context. Okay, so it's a nice and simple looking image, but if you think about it for any length of time, you'll see it's only a simplified image, and each of these concepts has a very large, complicated literature. Okay, so if we what we need to do then, if we have this kind of one way of understanding this environment, it helps us interpret a much more complicated literature in which we're going back to 101 different ways to describe it. Each of them, in their own way, are trying to explain some combination of a huge amount of minor policy change and a small amount of major policy change. I think, however much we struggle to define minor and major and distinguish between minor and major, that is essentially what people are trying to describe. If you look at policy change in political systems, there's a huge amount of small changes and a small amount of big changes. Okay, so the classic way to analyze that was through incrementalism, which at some point was thought to describe A, what happens, and B, how to act. So it used to be thought of as a good description of the policy process because it describes a lot of non-radical change within a political system. And it would also give you guidance on how to act within a political system, so to avoid the pursuit of comprehensive rationality and such like. But it doesn't really help us that much in either case. So the normative side of incrementalism, I think, was always questionable because there was always this assumption that you had a pluralist political system and the current settlement was okay, and therefore incremental departures from it were okay. Okay, and that received a lot of debate over the years. But for our purposes, the biggest problem with incrementalism now is that it does not explain the policy process particularly well, or at least modern policy theories suggest that it doesn't explain things very well. So instead, punctuated equilibrium theory tends to be seen as a better description of policymaking because it can explain the same sense of hyper-incrementalism, you know, a huge number of small changes, but it also is better able to explain why there is a small but a significant number of huge changes. And they go into that in some depth, and they do so with reference to two phrases that I think you'll become familiar with. So one is disproportionate information processing, which just means that people pay disproportionate attention to some information at the expense of all the rest, which we've talked about already. And this sense of institutional friction, which is the equivalent within policymaking organisations. They have particular rules that if they don't change, they affect the ways in which people process issues. Okay, but there are a huge number of concepts or theories from which to choose to try and capture the same kind of stuff. So I'll give you a few more to get into. So one is new institutionalism, which we've talked about before. It's connected to punctuated equilibrium to some extent because it uses the same language of long periods of stability to explain continuity, and then critical junctures or instability to explain change. But now the modern literature tends to focus on gradual changes in institutions with these profound effects. So if you get into it, if you look into the source material there, that's a kind of, people are looking for a language to explain why you can have these gradual changes to institutions over time have this profound impact on them. Then you have multiple streams analysis, which tends to describe the absence of major change unless it happens during a window of opportunity, when three things happen. You know, policymakers pay a large amount of attention to a problem, a feasible solution exists, and policymakers have the motive and opportunity to select it. Okay. If those conditions are met, there may be a major policy change. If they're not met, then very little changes. Then you have the advocacy coalition framework, which suggests that long periods of continuity are associated with stability within subsystems, and instability relates to something they often call shocks. So an internal shock is when people within the subsystem perceive there to be some degree of policy failure, or an external shock is when events or choices external to the subsystem have a profound effect on that subsystem. Then there are studies of policy narratives, you know, narrative policy framework or social construction, which suggests that narratives can reinforce stability and continuity for long periods of time, you know, if there's a dominant story that exists within a system or subsystem, or in some cases these narratives can be used to motivate change. And then there's a kind of growing literature on complex systems, which suggests that the systems can dampen central government initiatives for change, or they can cause policy change to emerge from local levels, and so on. You know, there are so many different ways in which you can try and explain these things. So take homes for now, take home messages. I think it would be fourfold, you know. So number one, consider bounded rationality and how people deal with it. So we need a kind of a working language or knowledge on how we describe the cognitive shortcuts that people use, the organizational equivalents, and the different ways in which each theory describes one aspect of that process. Okay, so there's a huge number of cognitive biases or heuristics that people identify, but each theory kind of focuses on a small number of those. Second thing would be identify a policy-making environment and its constituent parts, which we do with reference to those five or six concepts, but then note how each theory describes that environment in a very different way, often with reference to different words or concepts. And then finally, we need to find a way to compare those theories and perhaps combine them. But I would warn against combining them in a kind of fairly straightforward way.